You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Good morning and welcome to Pathways. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Every Sunday morning at this time, we invite you to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. Today's program is about sex, time, and power, which is the name of a book entitled Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution by Leonard Schlain, our guest on Pathways today. Dr. Schlain has been on this program before, soon after the release of his last book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image, a book which had a profound effect on me personally, along with millions of others as it climbed onto the bestseller list. In fact, I consider that book to be one of the most profound books on the evolution of patriarchal human society ever written. Leonard is also the author of Art and Physics, Parallel Visions in Space, Time, and Light. He has written for many publications and lectures widely. He is the chief of laparoscopic surgery at California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco and lives in the Bay Area. Good morning, Leonard, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Hey, I'm glad to be back, Paul.
The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, it was just an awesome work, and I would suspect that it did pretty well in the marketplace.
It did. It's now used as a textbook in many universities around the world because it's been translated into a series of different languages, too.
Some of the insights and the realizations in that book about the power of literacy to shape the left brain dominance and this were pretty radical. I'm wondering what new realizations about the evolution of humanity inspired you to write your new book, Sex, Time, and Power?
Well, Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution, is a, I look upon it as a sequel to Alphabet Versus the Goddess, because although I identified literacy as a factor in being one of the root causes of patriarchy and misogyny, I felt I hadn't explored the question far enough back, because obviously there are hardwired evolutionary adaptive changes in humans that affect the relationship between men and women. And this all goes back to a question that it's always puzzled me, and that is, why do humans mate the way they do? There are 3 million sexually reproducing species, and for all the rest of them, it's pretty much done exactly the same way. The female has a distinct estrus period, heat, rutting season, whatever you call it. She gives off an incredibly clear signal. It's usually olfactory, but it can be visual. The males come from miles around. They fight among each other. The biggest and the strongest wins, and then he mates the female at the precise moment that her ovary releases an egg, and sperm meets ovum, and the next generation is conceived. My God, what could be more straightforward or simpler than that? It's worked for millions of years for millions of species. So then if you look at the human species, we don't do it that way. The human female doesn't give off any signal that a man can consciously detect. I mean, in fact, women themselves don't often know when they ovulate. They have to go to Walgreens and buy a thermometer. So what would have been the adaptive advantage to humans abandoning what had been the premier gene-replicating system used for millions of years? And then if you examine our sexuality and reproductive life cycles, there's a whole bunch of other features, particularly in the human female, that are quite extraordinary. For example, there are 4,000 species of mammals, and 3,999 of them manage to pump out litters of 8, 10, 12 kits, cubs, piglets. and they don't menstruate. I mean, there's a handful of mammals that do menstruate, but the one that bleeds the most and bleeds the most often is a human. So the question is, I think all your listeners would agree that blood is a pretty vital substance to a mammal's health and vigor. So what on earth would be the benefit? Why is this sitting in our genome? Why hasn't it been culled out a long time ago? And I relate in the book a whole series of other features of human female sexuality, and male for that matter. You know, the fulsome orgasms, early menopause, excessive masturbation, all of these strange things you just don't see in other animals to the degree that they appear in humans. And I believe that they're all related to a catastrophe that befell our species at its very outset. And that is that we had two evolutionary adaptations that were destined to collide. The first one occurred about 4 million years ago when we stood up. We are the only bipedal mammal in existence that moves on only two legs instead of four habitually. And when you stand up, a very interesting thing happens. You position a mass of intestines directly above your rectum, which means that you are at risk when you go for a stroll after a particularly heavy lunch at being turned inside out. Now, that's not a gravitational hazard that exists for fish or reptiles or birds or mammals. They all move with their vertebral column horizontal to the earth. We move it perpendicular. So if you look at a picture of the human pelvis, it resembles a bowl because that's the way it's shaped. It's designed to contain this mass of intestines. And the hole in the pelvis is very small compared to other animals. A 200-pound gorilla delivers a 3-pound infant, and a 100-pound human female delivers a 7-pound infant. That's a problem. About 500,000 years ago, the human brain underwent a hyperinflation routine, gaining a whole pound of neural tissue added to the brain. So now we have a woman who's carrying a very, very big brain baby sitting above a very narrow little hole in her pelvis. So for the first time in any higher life form, human females began to experience great difficulty delivering their young, and some of them began to die in childbirth.
You say this was 150,000 years ago?
Well, I think that this became a crisis when the brain finished its rapid growth period, and we then evolved from Homo erectus into Homo sapiens. And I think that the defining, see, nobody knows why did we evolve? I mean, what was the reason why we needed this big brain? What would have been the environmental stress that would have produced a new species? And I think that women began to die in childbirth, leading to the paradoxical fact that the single greatest cause of death for human females today remains childbirth. If you go check the cemeteries in any country prior to the 20th century, you'll notice the extremely young ages in which women are on their tombstones. So women needed to understand the connection between sex and pregnancy. I mean, there are 3 million species that are out there doing it, and there is nothing in their observable behavior that leads anybody to believe that any of them have the slightest idea what the function of sexes is.
So, and why is that? So that they can avoid becoming pregnant?
Well, women needed to understand the connection, because if they were going to be dying as a result of having sex, they needed to understand that connection. So some woman somewhere must have said, oh, wait a minute, this kicking in my belly is the result of that transient moment of pleasure I had with that guy over there 5 months ago. And then if she projects herself a few months into the future, she realizes that she's risked her life to have sex.
Yeah, but how does that help her survive?
Because she then acquires a power that no female of any other species has ever had, and that is the power to refuse sex when she's ovulating. And as any man listening to this program knows, that changed everything. I mean, women understood for the first time the relationship, and then acquiring this power gave them veto power over sex, which in combination with a very strange thing that was happening to men, you know, the human male is the most sex-crazed male of any other species. There's no non-human male that wants to have sex all the time. I mean, a stallion that would try to mount a mare who wasn't in heat would get kicked in a very sensitive place, and that would be the end of him. So here you have the male of the human species evolving this turbocharged sex drive that he wants to have sex, and some men want to have sex with elderly women in nursing homes, dead women, drugged women, menstruating women, pubescent boys, little girls, intakes on vacuum cleaners. I mean, I've worked in emergency rooms. I've seen the beasts, by the way, do not practice bestiality. So here we have a male. I mean, there's never been a dissonance of desire like there has been among humans. So now we have a male that is absolutely crazed, and a female has the power to say no. So the first male must have gone up to the first female and gone, come on, baby, let's do it. And she said, you know what? You smell bad, you're ugly, you're stupid, we're not doing it. So he walked away completely confounded, because no male of any non-human species has ever had to confront a female with a mind of her own. I mean, there's an occasional female of non-human species that can choose which male she wants to have sex with, and some can refuse to have sex occasionally. But nobody other than a human, no other species other than a human, can consistently do it, can be celibate if they desire.
Okay, so I understand your point that women's intelligence outstripped that of men because...
It's not that they outstripped it, it's just that they made the connection between sex and pregnancy before the men did.
Which gave them political power.
Incredible power, yes.
In the relationship with men, but it didn't improve their survival.
Well, the my book is written... from the point of view, you could write the history of our species from the perspective that men have spent the last 150,000 years trying to regain the power that they so emphatically lost when women gained veto power over sex. Because you see, the reason that the word time is in the title of my book is that I believe that the ultimate weapon of mass destruction is foresight. The reason that we humans have put all the other animals in our zoos and we're making them all extinct is because we can outsmart them. We know what they're going to do, and they don't know what we're going to do. I mean, you could take the smartest dog and you can say, I'll meet you in 2 weeks on this corner. He won't show up. I mean, you know, you can't ask a frog what he had for lunch yesterday. He doesn't remember. Lions don't think about what they're going to be doing next Tuesday. So when evolution worked out the aerodynamics of the wing, it released into the air millions of species of birds, but why is it that there's only one animal that you can make an appointment with in 2 weeks and they'll keep it? So the reason why, I think, is that it's very difficult to teach an animal foresight. So I think that the women's reproductive life cycle was reconfigured in such a way that they lost estrus, which was what all the other females have, this intense period where their instincts and hormones drive them to mate. And that leaves only one circadian rhythm left, and that's menses. And then menses became extraordinarily exaggerated so that it reached a point where no woman could ignore it. And then all of the women synchronized their menses. What an odd thing. I mean, chimpanzees don't do that. Bonobos don't do that.
They don't?
No, they don't synchronize. They don't all come into estrus at the same time. So the human...
Do they have menstruation?
There's a few species of primates, 31 of them, that do, and of those that do, they bleed very minimally, except chimpanzees, and they very rarely have many menses because they're pregnant and nursing all the time. But the humans synchronized their menses so that they would all be bleeding at the same time. Now, the conductor orchestrating this harmony happens to be an inert object 250,000 miles out in space called the moon. How convenient. The average length of a menstrual cycle of 40,000 women over a 10-year period turned out to be 29.5 days. The average length of a lunar cycle is 29, not the average, exact length of a lunar cycle is 29.5 days. Now, chimpanzees are 37 days, bonobos are 42 days, you know, gorillas are 28 days, monkeys are 24 days. There's no other animal that has 29.5, which just so happens to be a lunar month. So over thousands of years, you have ancestral women sitting around in tribes where they're all bleeding at the same time when the big white object is not in the sky. And somebody said, wait a minute, there's a pattern here. And the word month, moon, measurement, and menses have the same roots in Greek and Latin in all the languages. You can find important myths in every culture in the world connecting the moon with measurement and time. So I think that women paid a price to understand this incredible gift called foresight. They taught it to their sons and lovers, and the men became the most fearsome predators on the face of the planet because the guys could sit around and say, you know, the elephants are coming through this pass in about 3 weeks, like just like they've done for the last 17 years. What do you say we set up an ambush and kill them? And, of course, there's no predator that can think that far ahead without having seen or smelled its prey. So the men then discovered a terrifying fact, and that is that they realized they were going to die. Now, women know they're going to die, but men are much more frightened to die than women are. I know this from being a surgeon for 35 years and having to tell a lot of people they have a terminal illness. Men across the board take this news much harder. They want the most radical surgery. They want the most radical chemotherapy. If you look at the AIDS epidemic, the women were all rushing to get the test, and the men just didn't want to know. So the men, being terrified of death, invented religions. And religions all contain stories about where you go after you die. So whether it's Avalon or Hades or the land of the dead or, you know, Valhalla or the happy hunting ground or heaven or hell, these are all phantasmagorias that men invented to alleviate their terror of death. And then some man somewhere said, wait a minute, this woman who I had sex with 9 months ago is having a baby, and this baby is actually my baby. And when those two insights about sex and death crisscrossed in his mind, an explosion happened in his brain, and the concept of paternity came forward. And the man suddenly realized that if he knew who his children were, and he could name them, and he could give them his skill and his weapons and his property, then he could achieve a certain degree of immortality. He could cheat death a little bit by knowing who his children were. A woman never doubts who her children were because they come right through her. Man never knows for sure. So the man went to the women and he said, you know, we've been having a lot of fun having sex, but from now on, you have to be a virgin when I marry you, and I'll stone you to death afterwards, because that's the only way I'm going to know for sure who these children are. And it's critical for me to achieve some degree of immortality by leaving a lineage or a legacy. And I have to be able to name these kids. The women said, well, that's not a real good idea. I got a better one. How about if you stand up in front of all of our friends and family, your mother and father, my mother and father, big public assembly of all the people whose respect you cannot afford to lose, and you take a solemn public oath saying, I do, that you will keep me supplied in resources so that I can devote my time to raising these children that we're going to have that maybe will be yours. But this is your best shot at achieving immortality. And the guy looks at her and he says, what are you, crazy? I mean, everybody knows that a man wants to fool around. Why would I ever agree to such a restrictive arrangement? And she looks at him and she says, well, you know, do you want to fool around, or do you want to cheat death? You know, I mean, do you want to leave a legacy, or do you want to just have a bunch of meaningless relationships? And it's very interesting. The men overwhelmingly agree to this semi-permanent relationship called marriage, which, of course, benefits women and children mightily. But let us not lose sight of the fact that the reason that men get married, one of the reasons that men get married, is to legitimize their heirs in the eyes of their peers. You know, by getting married and having an issue, they're saying to the world, these children are mine and they get my stuff, okay? So men have had to construct misogynist and patriarchal societies because they've got to do two things. They want to abrogate a woman's right to choose which lover they're going to take, because if women have free choice, then the men aren't going to know who the children are. And secondly, the men have to control the women's reproductive rights, because that's the only way they can achieve immortality. So the veto power over sex is the root of a woman's power, and it becomes the source of his anger. It's the frustration that men experience having to jump through all these hoops to get a woman to say yes.
You know, I'm wondering, how do you go so far back? What kind of techniques do you use? You know, I mean, when language... Some theories have it that language spoken language didn't really arrive until as recently as 10,000 years ago.
Oh, no, spoken language is, I think spoken language was present at the outset of our species. And the reason we know that is that Homo sapiens compared to Homo erectus or Homo habilis or Neanderthals have an enormously tall larynx. They have a great big hypoglossal nerve going to their tongue. They have huge holes in their foramen, as they're called, in their upper vertebral column, so that the nerves exiting the spinal cord can control the muscles of respirations for speech. And those adaptations were present at the outset of our species, and I can't believe that they would be sitting there doing nothing for 50,000, 100,000 years. So we were talking pretty effectively at the outset. Now, whether we became fully conscious until more recently, I think 40,000 years ago is the break point, because that's the time called the creative explosion, when all of a sudden we started creating representational art. We consistently started burying our dead. There's evidence of ritual everywhere, and there's evidence of grave goods that are perfectly usable crafts that are placed in these tombs. And we don't find the evidence of that in strong degree prior to this.
Well, I mean, if I didn't even know you could find anything going back 40,000 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you go to France, you can find the caves of Chavet, 28,000 years ago, contained the most spectacular art, light years ahead of the scratchings of bones and stones that you find earlier back. So when you ask me, how do I do my research? I mean, I'm, you know, as a physician and a surgeon, I'm steeped in physiology, metabolism, anatomy, and I've had a lifelong interest in archaeology and evolution and biology. So I've just combined two fields that I love to kind of attempt to reconstruct what happened a long time ago.
So how long ago did we figure out the connection between sex and reproduction?
Well, I think that men and women pretty much mated like the animals did until women gained the veto power over sex and men understood the concept of paternity. And when those two things happened, for the first time, men had to negotiate sex with females. You know, with very, very few exceptions, there are very few women who would ever have sex with a man unless there's something is exchanged. And either he has to say, whisper, I love you, in her ear, or he has to give her $100 bill, or he has to give her a diamond ring, or, you know, promise her something. Because women understand that that is their power. Now, men can rape because they're bigger and stronger, and they certainly, rape is a major problem for our species compared to other species. But if all the men raped, it wouldn't solve the problem, because no man would know who his children were. So paradoxically, it's the men that have devised the most draconian punishments for rapists, because they understand that if men are all going to be sure of paternity, they've got to stop rape. Of course, in cases of war, all bets are off, but in general, within a given society, a rapist is very severely dealt with by the other men.
Okay, so now that we know this, you know, and those of us who don't know it can learn it from reading your book, what are the implications as far as you're concerned? I mean, moving forward, you know, what's the lesson?
Well, I think it, you know, Freud pointed out that we really can't make changes unless we first understand some of the unconscious motives, what drive us to what we do. And I think that it's important that we understand who we are from a evolutionary point of view, because we've been in existence 150,000 years as Homo sapiens. That's a pretty young species. And for the 99% of that time, we lived as hunter-gatherers. Well, actually about 97%. So we're all walking around with the nervous systems of hunter-gatherers, with a sharp division of labor between men and women as to what they do. And then, of course, 8,000 years ago, we completely reversed all that by introducing the agricultural revolution. And then 200 years ago, we had the industrial revolution. And now we've got the technological revolution, complete with the most mind-bending advances in obstetrics and in vitro fertilization. Women don't die in childbirth anymore. I mean, in first world countries, it's considered, and if you hear of somebody who dies in childbirth, it's a major event, you know, because it just doesn't happen anymore with cesarean sections and asepsis and all these other advances. So we're at a hinge point right now as a species, because we've broken free of the restraints that have held us in the past, But unless we understand where we came from, it's going to be very difficult to understand where we're going.
And where should we go? I mean, we've only got a couple minutes left, but if and that's a shame because we could talk all day about this. Yeah. Fascinating.
Well, where we're going is, I think that what's happening is that we're metamorphosing as a species. I mean, if I pointed out that there was a caterpillar crawling across this table here, and I said, "Would you believe that this caterpillar was going to turn into a butterfly?" and you didn't know that that could happen, you'd say that's impossible. But it happens all the time in nature. It's called metamorphosis. So I think that humans are metamorphosing into a new species, but it's not taking the typical form of changing its physical form. It's changing as a result of all our knowledge and technology and our ability to manipulate our own genome, and that is changing us and will continue to do so. You know, when you're in the center of a spinning washing machine, it's hard to tell that the clothes are getting cleaner. You know, I mean, we're in the midst of this tremendous revolution, and it's very difficult to know exactly what's happening as a result of that.
You know, Leonard, this book is so fascinating. There's so many things in here that we could talk about that we don't have time to talk about today, like how did humans evolve speech? How did we discover time? And you've talked a little bit about that today. What's the purpose of the G-spot?
Right.
How did homosexuality evolve?
Right.
Just a treasure trove of fascinating insights here. And I'm so happy that you wrote this book, being a big fan of your first book. Is there a way, other than going down to the bookstore and buying the book,
right,
that people can learn more about your work in general?
I have a website, sextimepower.com, just all one word, that they can go to. There's a bulletin board there, and there's some, you know, we'll be posting typical chapters and whatnot. So, and, you know, the book is already creating a buzz. It was number one on some bestseller list down in the Bay Area and got just a smash review in the Chronicle view. Front page of the Chronicle book review section last week. It's only been out a week or so.
Wow.
So it's going, you know. And then, of course, you know, there'll be those who criticize me for, because I'm not an anthropologist and I'm not a academic, even though I am a professor of surgery at UCSF. But, you know, people outside of fields can make contributions to other fields just because they're not a specialist in it. I mean, let us not forget that Alvarez, who was an astronomer, solved the problem, whatever happened to the dinosaurs, that the biologists have been scratching their heads about for years, you know. So I think I'm making a valuable contribution, because as a surgeon, I understand blood loss. Probably there's very few people in our society that have studied this problem as much as I have, as much as my field has. And we know the metabolism, and we know a lot of the physiology.
Well, as one of your fans, I'm glad that you are delving into these other fields to help us understand how we evolved as a species. And I want to let our listeners know that the name of your latest book is Sex, Time, and Power: How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution, by Leonard Schlain. And this book is available at the finer bookstores in Portland, including a New Renaissance bookstore. And I think you'll find it interesting. Leonard, thank you very much for being with us on Pathways again. It's been a great pleasure.
It's my pleasure too, Paul. Thank you.
And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to Pathways for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. Today we've been talking to author Leonard Schlain, the author of the book Sex, Time, and Power: How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. On behalf of KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, and the Pathways program, this is Paul O'Brien signing.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Dee 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 d in the city where I'm working like a walrus. But man, I don't need your money, man, I'm gonna be an artist. And I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. I put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent. But that won't even matter when I lose my apartment. I don't really have no worries, I'll be just like a cassette that you've taped up the tabs of to put something new on it. And when I hit record, God only knows what I will be. And if there is no God, then it's a better mystery. Survival, and I guess
you're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements.